Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host. And I don't know if he's the greatest endocrinologist because we have another really great endocrinologist on here, but we'll call him the greatest guy endocrinologist at the moment. We've been waiting for this podcast for a while to make schedules work. We got Dr. Hurtado and Dr. Castaneda on here to talk about their recent, actually big on social media, recent analyses looking at menopausal hormonal therapy and the relationship with GLP-1 medicine, specifically the latest one is tirzepatide. There was one last year looking at semaglutide, and a categorical and total amount of weight loss in those who don't take the menopausal hormonal therapy versus those who do with a GLP-1 medicine. So we wanted to talk about it. We've chatted a little bit. We had Dr. Beverly Chang, who did an analysis of the SURMOUNT trials looking at if they could figure out a difference between the two. But we figured we'd bring on the actual researchers here today to talk about their analyses. They're at the Mayo Clinic, right? The Mayo Clinic, Dr. Castaneda is a research fellow right now, likely going to be internal medicine, then endocrine, we think.
Heck yeah.
And Dr. Hurtado is a board certified endocrinologist and obesity medicine specialist, doing mostly clinical research, but does also see patients and does a lot of research in obesity medicine. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation too.
Yeah. You actually messaged me on Instagram because I here's what happens. Basically, non-researcher people take some information and just blow it up. And so I'm like, okay, hold on a second. Let's look at the caveats and stuff. And you're like, hey, I'd love to chat. That was actually my study. I'm like, oh my God, thank God. I didn't know you're on social media, so we're like, let's make this happen. So thanks so much for coming on to discuss.
No, thank you for having us here. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Following the presentation at this national conference, we received a lot of social media attention. And I think that I'm particularly very thankful that you took the time to clarify and explain to your followers our research. So I think that was fantastic.
Well, now we need you to explain it because you'll do a better job. Our big thing is like making sure that we're not overhyping things, but also like, hey, if there's a signal here, let's study it further. And I think that's what you all did. So why don't you explain like why you even looked into this? Let's hear the background a little bit.
Yes.
Perhaps I can tell everyone a little bit about the background, because we started working on this area prior to Regina joining our team. And what we had been realizing is that menopausal women go to the Women's Health Center, or they come to see endocrinology, and their major concern, besides the very bothersome vasomotor symptoms, is weight gain, particularly in the central distribution. And so, sometimes they are even more bothered about these changes in body composition than the vasomotor symptoms themselves. So it's a very, it provokes a lot of anxiety. Women are worried. They want to do something about it. They feel that they don't change anything. Perhaps they even exercise a little bit more, and they cannot prevent the changes in body composition that they experience as they are going through the menopausal transition. And we also noted in the clinical practice that some of the women that were experiencing weight gain or already had gained the weight and we were treating for obesity, overweight or obesity, were not achieving the amount of weight loss that we would expect for people based on the large pivotal trials. And that's why we decided to look into this. And at that time, 3 years ago, we started looking at the data on semaglutide, and our results were very interested, and we wanted to make sure we could replicate that. So we started looking into tirzepatide's effects in postmenopausal women with and without hormone therapy. So that's the clinical background. It was an observation that we had during clinical practice, and we thought it was very important to try to identify if there is truly a difference and try to explain that difference. And that's where we are right now, trying to explain that difference.
Very cool. So let me go back and see if we can say it from our perspective, because we did talk a little bit about the background in our podcast with Beverly Ching. And of course, we've looked into this too.
Not this some newest the, analysis, though, I don't think. We were talking about this.
Well, I'm talking about the background.
Oh, yeah.
So she did the post-hoc analysis of tirzepatide. So there... You know, and we looked through this, and there have been some publications, and I don't know if you guys were involved in some of these sort of hypothesis generating type papers.
Biological plausibility papers.
Yeah. Why is it possible that there's some interaction? And there certainly is some background into the estrogen, GLP interaction type stuff, you know, in some of the bench research, some of the sort of the preclinical, what we call preclinical studies, suspecting that premenopausal females with, you know, before they lose their estrogen, seem to respond maybe the best in the clinical trials. Does that sound kind of right to you? Or at least there's a trend towards
and
that
men,
benefit.
Men don't respond as well.
Not quite as statistically well. Obviously, to these medications, everyone responds. Not everyone, but most people respond pretty well. They're the most efficacious things we have. But there was that sort of difference. And then going back in time even further, we know, and just kind of, you can kind of clarify this in your own words, but historically, like you said, going through menopause, people tend to gain some weight, specifically the distribution of the weight, which is less desirable to have abdominally, viscerally, rather than sort of what we call peripherally sort of thing. And, you know, and I remember going through fellowship, I can't believe I'm saying over 10 years ago now, that menopausal hormone therapy during the menopausal transition seemed to at least help a little bit mitigate the weight gain, the changes in body composition. But of course, the indications for menopausal hormone therapy have always been the vasomotor symptoms, they feel better, they sleep better, and thus, you know, there are other aspects to it too. And so there's a lot of different confounding factors in it. But to me, that was kind of the background of it. And then it's like, okay, so does it matter? And your studies have certainly raised the bigger question. But what kind of studies are what you guys looked at? Because you didn't look at the randomized controlled trials. You're looking at some observational.
You're looking at their
stuff,
EMR data, right?
Yep. It is our own data. And it's, you're right. It's an observational study, retrospective study. So there are a lot of limitations. And hopefully, in the future, we will have a randomized controlled trial so we can analyze things prospectively. So yes, we reported an association between the use of hormone therapy with greater weight loss. However, we were not able to establish causality, and we were very careful and cautious during the conference with the publication of the abstract. However, yes, the headlines, I think, were misleading. But we're not saying that hormone therapy, we're not promoting the use of hormone therapy for weight loss. We are reporting an observation, an association, but we need more studies. We need more controlled trials to first confirm this and then explore what is the underlying mechanism. Because you're right, we may have introduced healthy user bias. We are potentially seeing just a group that is feeling better and it's now better for them to just engage in physical activity to a healthier diet. Or maybe there's still a possibility that this preclinical data is playing a role, right? There could be this synergistic interaction between estrogen and GLP-1 signaling. So we need to explore that. And I think that's the relevance of our study. We need to look at this.
Very cool. All right. Can you go over how you set up the study? I was just reviewing it. It was actually bigger than the one from semaglutide. You had a bigger subset of population. So I think that's pretty cool if you could go over that.
Yes. So this is a one-year real-world study. So chart review was involved. And we identified only 40 postmenopausal women that were using hormone therapy concomitantly with tirzepatide. And then we have about 300 postmenopausal women that were not using hormone therapy. So it wasn't fair to just compare both groups. That's why we ended up doing a propensity score matching, because the groups were imbalanced. Like, there was more diabetics in the 400 group. So we tried to match them, trying to simulate what we are seeing in trials. We were doing a propensity score matching. So now the groups look similar, and then we were confident to compare them. We evaluated the weight loss outcomes through a specific time point, the last follow-up. We also evaluated the lipid panel, glucose, weight-promoting medication use, history of diabetes, previous history of obesity medication. And we analyzed a lot in the abstract, and during the conference, we presented the weight loss outcomes. Once our paper is published, you will be able to see also the cardiovascular outcomes that we analyzed.
Very cool. So this isn't actually published. It was just the abstract
that was presented.
Right? So I could still see the abstract at the so it hasn't been. So we don't. So for anybody listening, remember my brother got in trouble for talking about something that was embargoed. So we're going to not push too hard.
And we released the podcast literally the. Anyways,
well, whatever. We're going to be very careful just to go over what we're presented and not go into any more details so they don't get in trouble. Very
Do
cool.
We know when it's going to be published, in case we want to simultaneously release it, if it's like next week or something?
Do you know if it's going to be?
We hope it is accepted sooner than later. We're hoping for an answer within the next couple of weeks, maybe even sooner than that. But I think talking about the methodology of the study is extremely important. Again, we have highlighted a couple of times that this was a retrospective study. And the retrospective studies have a lot of limitations. Regina has pointed out some of these limitations. But I also want to put into perspective the amount of work that was put into this paper and this data to make sure that we kept it as clean as possible. At Mayo Clinic, we have a very large volume of patients. A lot of our patients are complex patients that are referred for management of complex diseases, and it is important to keep that in mind. So we have actually a database of more than 5,000 individuals that have been prescribed tirzepatide at Mayo Clinic. I think the list is, now that we checked, more than 10,000, close to 12,000, right, Regina?
All right.
And from all these patients, even though we have methods of extracting data in an automated way, we still have to go one by one and make sure that what these reports are telling us is true, making sure that patients are taking the medications. Because one thing is that they get a prescription. The other question is, are they actually taking the medication? Are they taking it on a weekly basis? Did they have to stop the medication for how long? What the reason was for stopping the medication? And it was the same with hormone therapy. Probably among the 5,000 patients, it was actually 5,000 women that when we started looking at the tirzepatide and hormone therapy data, more than 5,000 women that we had to go through, and a significant proportion of women, at least 10% of these women had some type of record of being on hormone therapy. And then we started looking, making sure the hormone therapy was taken at the same time as tirzepatide, which was not the case for the majority of patients. So we had all these criteria that we had to go through and manually review charts of thousands of patients to make sure that we had the most accurate data. And we ended up with what we believe is a small sample, but this is the first time that a study like this has been done, and the results are significant, which again is an empirical observation. We found some evidence that there is a signal. Now it is our job as researchers that want to advance medicine, promote the individualized treatment of obesity. It's our job to investigate whether this signal that we're seeing is true and what are the clinical implications of this. And that's our next step.
I love that you're talking like scientists, as you are, of course, but you know, the social media world, most of these people aren't scientists, even though they're doctors, they'll like take a headline and just run with it. I love that you guys have.
Unfortunately, though, I think some of that is marketing and money and driven and stuff like that.
Well, yeah. I know
some people that were just.
Even the journalists, even the, you know, the people out there newspapers and whatever other place,
that's
media
classic,
basically will take it. I know there is actually Dr. Hurtado, were you at the obesity week? It was like 2018 or something, where there was a whole session on, hey, we're about to, it was a low fat versus low carb study. And they had a whole session on making sure that the media got the headlines correct. I don't know. You may not remember.
I was pregnant in 2018. So perhaps I don't remember necessarily going to that one.
But it's essentially they said, now here are all the caveats. Make sure you get this right. They didn't get it right. They even told them exactly how to make sure that the headlines, it didn't matter. But I do, you know, you both are clearly being very careful in your language. So yeah, what is the next step? I've actually talked about how to do a randomized trial, but like I want to hear from your words of how you would actually do this. I would love to hear it.
I could jump in. So
either you or doctor, because it doesn't matter.
So, you know, there are so many things that we need to take into consideration, but a randomized trial would be taking menopausal women who have an indication for hormone therapy and randomize them to either get a semaglutide or semaglutide with hormone therapy, perhaps a third group, because you cannot have women who have an indication for hormone therapy, meaning vasomotor symptoms, be in a long study without treatment for their vasomotor symptoms.
That's the problem.
Now, let me tell you something. In my clinic, I partner with the Women's Health Center at Mayo Clinic, so we work closely, and they send me their patients, I send them their patients, and what we have seen, and we actually have a study coming up, is that women who lose a substantial amount of weight on this one or other medications, but again, we're seeing a more substantial amount of weight loss with these newer medications, notice that their vasomotor symptoms improve. So what we started seeing in the clinic is that I would have patients who come to see me for weight management. I start them on a medication for weight management. And during my evaluation, I do an in-depth assessment of anything that may affect their weight loss outcomes. And untreated vasomotor symptoms for me is one of the things that I always ask about. And if they have untreated vasomotor symptoms, I will refer them to the Women's Health Center, and they would get to the Women's Health Center appointment 2-3 months down the road, and my vasomotor symptoms are gone. And it is not expected, because we do know that excess adiposity, especially early in menopause, is associated with a higher incidence and severity of vasomotor symptoms. And losing weight may help with that. But the significant improvement was very intriguing for both the Women's Health Center and for me. So we're actually going to start a study. It's going to be a short duration study, proof of concept study, pilot study, looking into the effect of tirzepatide for the treatment of vasomotor symptoms in postmenopausal women. Mm-hmm. Kind of going back to an ideal prospective clinical trial, if we can consider using another non-hormonal treatment that has been proven to be effective for vasomotor symptoms, is something that we can consider as a third group. And we need to take a look beyond vasomotor symptoms. Vasomotor symptoms are the cardinal symptoms of menopause, but now we have learned more and more that that menopause transition, the decline in estrogen, is associated with a whole myriad of symptoms, cardiometabolic risks. So we actually need to take a look into how those improve with the addition of a medication that we know not only results in weight loss, but may have some weight loss independent cardiometabolic benefits. And that's, you know, our goal, trying to provide women who are living with overweight or obesity, or women who are experiencing a substantial amount of weight, with personalized, individualized treatment options that can target multiple issues at the same time. It's not about putting women on 10 different types of medications. We know that obesity is the keystone of many health problems. And if we can target obesity, we may be able to improve all these other things.
Yeah, very.
So talking, for example, about genitourinary syndrome in this woman, urinary incontinence, there is already some evidence that they may improve urinary incontinence. So this is something that needs to be investigated. And the right way of doing this is with a prospective trial, where we can collect all the data in the same way. We have missing data in our study. That's one of the limitations. So the only way of making sure that we are collecting all the data at the same time points is with a prospective clinical trial.
Yeah. And so just to get, I just kind of want to review, because you mentioned how those who, females who already struggle with weight, especially, you know, obesity or visceral obesity, tend to have a higher risk of the vasomotor symptoms, right? And then there's also this kind of chicken or the egg thing. So, you know, I just recall always seeing, you know, evidence, and it's a lot of it's observational, obviously, that those, because not everyone gets vasomotor symptoms. Some people get through the menopausal transition and they just don't even notice it, other than losing their menses unless they've had a hysterectomy. But those who do suffer vasomotor symptoms tend to also then have higher risk of weight gain, obesity, and cardiometabolic risk, along with some other risks, as far as I'm aware. So there's almost like this, you know, bi-directional pathway, chicken or the egg. And then now we're trying to figure out which one of these things may be clinically relevant to what we do to help people. So anybody who has vasomotor symptoms, especially earlier on in the menopausal transition, really should be strongly considering and discussing menopausal hormone therapy anyhow. Generally speaking, I mean, you know, and then, of course, if they are having obesity, they're going to be considering different types of medications, which also, I guess, would be interesting to think about what other, you know, obesity medications would have some relevance. But I don't, does that kind of, you know, from my sort of generalized thinking about it, does that make some sense as to what we're thinking about?
Yeah, that's totally true. And you're absolutely right. More frequent and more severe vasomotor symptoms have been associated with increased cardiovascular risk. And also, going a little bit back, I think that future studies should also explore body composition changes. I'm thrilled to see if beyond weight loss, we can also see different changes in body composition given estrogen's physiological effects. So that will be very interesting, in my opinion.
Would you do DEXA scans, Dr. Hurtado, with your RCT?
Yes, absolutely. I agree with Regina. We do know that hormone therapy, estrogen-based hormone therapies, can have a favorable effect. It's not, it's a modest effect on body composition, but if you are adding that to an intervention that is going to decrease adiposity, if you couple that with a strong lifestyle intervention focused on the right type of diet, right amount of protein intake, the right type of exercise for these women as they go through this transition, if we can truly mitigate and significantly improve body composition and eventually allow these women age healthily.
Here's a question. So in your clinical practice, I know my brother does this. We do this too. Like, do you think everybody who is doing obesity medicine, so when you're, do you prescribe the menopausal hormonal therapy, or do you refer at the Mayo Clinic?
Well, she said she works with
it. I do not. I do not prescribe menopausal hormone therapy. Yes, I do a screen. We, And again, it's a bi-directional relationship. They send me their patients. I send them my patients. Mm-hmm. So we're working closely together, but I personally do not prescribe menopause hormone therapy.
Okay. Here's what
we do, of course, we're kind of, I'm the only endocrinologist here. I'm kind of doing everything. But Spencer, you're not endocrine.
We do it because
you do the whole thing. Like you're doing
family medicine,
comprehensive obesity.
Right. Yeah.
Just holistic, approach.
Here's a question. So here's we talked through how we would do an RCT, because the thing is, if you don't treat the people who are having vasomotor symptoms, they're going to be miserable. So that's kind of a confounding variable. Would it be possible to get all the people that don't have vasomotor symptoms, but somehow you'd have to screen for being postmenopausal, then take those two people and randomize one to MHT plus a GLP-1 versus GLP-1 by itself?
Wait a second. Somehow screen for postmenopausal? Have you ever heard of menstrual cycles?
So they don't. Well, yeah. I'm saying.
They're not having symptoms,
and they could be. But if they're perimenopausal, they'd have to be postmenopausal. You'd have to confirm 12 months, and then are you saying would the IRB allow for you to give menopausal hormonal therapy even without that clear indication?
So that's a good point, right? There have been a lot of studies looking to hormone therapy. Some of these studies have raised questions about the use of hormone therapy and has led to the underprescription of hormone therapy. Now, taking all the data together, we have been able to understand how to use menopause hormone therapy, and we definitely need to consider the risks associated with it, because no type of therapy comes with risks. And even though this is something that could be considered, and if this is going to be prescribed for the short term, I think there could be an argument for that. But the reality is that that's not the people that we're going to eventually treat or consider this therapies for. So instead of, giving hormone therapy to someone who doesn't have an indication for hormone therapy, we can consider another treatment for vasomotor symptoms. Now, there are new treatments that are very effective for vasomotor symptoms, fezolinetant being one of those. So can we try planning a clinical trial that contains a combination of fezolinetant by itself, fezolinetant plus an obesity medication? And we have discussed this several times, and we still haven't identified what the best approach is. Most of all, because no pharmaceutical company may be necessarily interested in comparing two different medications, even though they have different mechanism of action. But these medications are expensive, whether we like it or not. Fezolinetant is also a medication that is hundreds of dollars a month. Weight loss medications, we have cheaper options. We have the injectables, which are the ones that we have looked into. And they are also hundreds of dollars a month. For research, thousands of dollars a month. We have discussed with pharmaceutical companies, and even though they have supported our research and they are very interested in us looking a little bit more into effect of these newer GLP-1 based agents in women's health and specific problems associated with midlife and the menopause transition, we always end up with, okay, we need to think about this better because this may not work. But we have options. We have options. Agents are being developed for the treatment of vasomotor symptoms. The question is how we pair those treatments and look at the outcomes and make sure that there are no confounders. Because like you said, vasomotor symptoms, they are extremely common. More than 80% of women will experience vasomotor symptoms. But at the same time, we have been living with those symptoms, not having to complain, even though they are affecting our quality of life in ways that we can not even start to understand. At least I cannot even start to understand yet. When I assess for vasomotor symptoms, I cannot tell you the amount of women that, yes, they have these very disruptive symptoms that do not allow them to rest at night, and they do not bring it up. They do not bring it up to their primary providers. They do not bring it up to anyone. And when I tell them that's not normal and we can do something about it, sometimes they are even surprised and they become more interested. So, hormone therapy is definitely underutilized, and as people learn more, as people have access to information, I think just like it happened with obesity medications, they are going to start asking and even requesting prescriptions or treatment for their symptoms.
Yeah, very of course, cool. This goes back, you know, many years ago to the Women's Health Initiative, when before we were all, any of us were even in med school, every postmenopausal female was on menopausal hormone therapy. And then the Women's Health Initiative scared everyone away. Mm-hmm. And then we've had to regroup, you know, divvy up the details, the timing hypothesis. We've talked about this, you know, a lot in, on the podcast, but that's just for people out there. I mean, yeah, it certainly, it comes up a lot in my world, but again, you guys and we have a little bit of a selection bias, so we're seeing them. So we do a ton of menopausal hormone therapy, and we use a lot of, I'll call it Veozah for people out there, is the medication she was talking about. That's the brand of the medicine she's talking about. That's non-hormonal therapy. And boy, it sure does a very good job for people who can't or, you know, maybe shouldn't or don't want menopausal hormone therapy. So yeah, I don't know. Do you have to come up with some sort of 4x4 trial design and all this stuff? I mean,
it's hundred feet.
And this is off topic, but I just, you guys made me think about this. So all these people online also, then they always dog Big Pharma. They say, oh, you know, the study was sponsored by Big Pharma. Oh, you got to discount it. But then they're also anti-funding like government-based, you know, research too.
Who's going to pay for this?
So who's going to pay for this? You guys are at the Mayo Clinic, one of the, you know, primary research clinical medical centers in the world, and you're talking about trying to get funding. And even then, the you know, the pharmaceutical companies are kind of, you know, it's hard to get the funding. So I don't know if you can speak to that for just a second. I didn't mean to go off the rails, but I just know everyone on social media, they just don't understand.
Yeah. As an early career investigator, we have a lot of challenges trying to get funding to answer very important research questions. And what I would say is the following. As researchers, we need to understand how research works. And we also need to keep in mind that the need of the patients comes always first. So when we are looking for funding for our research, and specifically when we reach out to pharma, their process to fund studies is very structured. So, for example, we're going to start a study with Eli Lilly, looking at the effect of tirzepatide on vasomotor symptoms in postmenopausal women. And we proposed the study. We wrote the protocol for the study. They reviewed the protocol and they agreed. But we are completely independent. This is an investigator-initiated study. They are going to give us the funding, and the plan is to publish the data, whether it is positive or negative, it works or not, in an unbiased way. That's something that we need to keep in mind. So yes, we're getting funding from pharma, but my role is as a researcher is making sure that I'm doing the research the right way, following all the rules and making sure that everything is reported accordingly. The type of studies that we do, we can plan them in a way that patients are blinded, we are blinded, and the only team that is not blinding is the pharmacy team, who is going to give the medications, and then the statistics team, eventually they will run the entire statistical analysis and they will report these results in an unblinded way. Group A and group B, this is what happened, this is what we saw, and then our job is like, okay, it ends up happening that group A is Z has received the medication and group B just received placebo. It's just the standard of research, and as long as we are good researchers, I think even though we are receiving funding from pharma, the research that we get done with those funds is extremely relevant and important.
Yeah, I love it. Not everyone gets the funding. Spencer and I tried to do a Lilly.
Yeah, probably because we're not at the Mayo Clinic. They said, who are these idiots?
We tried to, we proposed a trial for
professors. They don't deserve this. Let's give it to Grant.
We were trying to do strength training, stretch and strength training with tirzepatide. They loved it, but then allegedly someone beat us to it.
It's someone else is doing it. So we'll have the data.
We'll see if it's not as good as what we wanted to do. We're going to be so mad.
Yeah, they probably did it better.
Again, you know, funding can be tricky, and, you know, we have to do all sorts of things we have to be creative sometimes to be able to answer questions appropriately. Right now, for example, we do have another study in our lab we are recruiting postmenopausal women without hormone therapy, and we are looking into the effect of either semaglutide or tirzepatide on physical function. And we didn't get any funding from pharma. This was an internal grant that Mayo Clinic granted us. And we had to do this study in a pragmatic way to minimize the costs associated with research. And we had to pay the medication. I mean, this study had to pay the medication, and we're trying to figure out what is the easiest and cheapest way of getting the medication so we can recruit enough patients to get to complete the study. So funding is tricky. It's challenging. We have to be creative. And at the same time, we need to make sure that we maintain the highest standards to minimize confounders and report accurate data.
You two are great researchers. I'm excited to see Dr. Castaneda go through her training and do even more research. And I'm excited for you all to get that study published. This may be out before that study is published, because it usually gets accepted unless it's like first in press, blah, 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 blah. So be on the lookout, everyone who's listening to this, for that study to be published. But
The original one with semaglutide is,
yeah, we can put that in
published. That's ready to go.
Any last words before I go? Like, what if you wanted anybody to take away from this? Like, what would be the headline? What would you have wanted the media to make a headline based off of the abstract you presented? What would have been a better than what they did?
I think that some headlines were actually very appropriate. Like, they were reporting that. Like, researchers find an association between hormone therapy use and superior weight loss with tirzepatide. That's amazing.
Good.
Then, yeah, that's a good headline. And I think that the takeaway is that we're not promoting the use of hormone therapy for weight loss. We need further studies to confirm our findings. We need to explore the underlying mechanisms. I think we can find fascinating things. And the significant clinical implications of our research demand further investigation. So I think that the media attention that we're getting it literally translates to the significance of our findings. Postmenopausal women represent a vulnerable group with significant cardiometabolic changes. So I really like our project, and I think that in the future we will have more studies, and I'm so glad to have great mentors involved with this project.
You two are great.
Yeah, thank you for the work you're doing, for sure, and thank you for doing this.
Perhaps the only one thing that I would add is because all this started to appear in social media, I have received several messages from patients that I don't even treat, asking me specifically, I'm using this medication and things are not going in the right direction. Should I start hormone therapy? And I try to answer these patients and tell them, hey, if you're having vasomotor symptoms, I think this is important to consider. I cannot guarantee that you're going to lose more weight, because in our study, we couldn't say with certainty that it is specifically the use of hormone therapy that improved the weight loss outcomes. There could have been other things involved, and the type of study did not allow to identify those reasons. So again, the word association rather than other headlines that were, for example, should all women be on hormone therapy when they are using tirzepatide or semaglutide? And that's definitely not the message that we want to send. The use of hormone therapy should be individualized, i.e. we need to weigh risks, benefits. But if a woman has an indication for hormone therapy, I think it should be explored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You sound like a great doctor. And a great researcher.
That doesn't get the likes and the shares and the money and all things that colleagues do. Oh my God, everyone's got to be on all these things and everything. And
they like short snippet, very black
absolutely.
And white.
Absolutely.
Big hype.
Yeah. Hey,
thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to more research coming from your lab, and we'll love to have you on again at some point.
Very nice being here. Thank you for having us.
All right, everyone.
Thank you so much. It was so great to meet you.
Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.